All right, let's skip the Jamie Open because her time is short. We're going to Paris. We're going to the Olympics. She is the modern-day Jim McKay. She's covered Olympics after Olympics, and Jamie's with us. And her time is short because Simone Biles is just minutes away. Is it possible when you're talking to me that you're going to say, hey, Simone, I'll get you in like 10 minutes?
No, 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 because I only get 3 minutes with her, as does each of the people who are here. So wow. She is two away from me right now.
Okay.
She looks stunning, by the way, in a white jumpsuit. Just gorgeous. Makeup done, hair done. She's looking very confident after, you know, all the amazing things that she did here. So, unfortunately, I have to be a little quieter, too, because I'm trying to be respectful of the other media here.
Understand. What is the first question you're going to ask her?
Is she enjoying the moment?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, sometimes when there's so much pressure and you've trained so long and you ask athletes, and some, Jamie, say, oh, for sure, I loved it. I was, and they're like, others say, are you kidding me? I can enjoy it maybe afterwards, or maybe I need a month. But it is interesting how they process it.
Yeah, I mean, she's talked a lot about that. Just, you know, obviously I covered her in 2021 during the Tokyo Olympics as well. And that was something where, you know, she really did start talking about her mental health and everything that went into her routines and the pressure she felt and getting the twisties and coming out of that. And I think that's why this is truly a celebration with her leaving here. I know there's been a lot of talk about the balance beam and the silver on floor in the last 24 hours because those were the last events. But I think we can't forget that over the course of this entire Olympics, how she's stepped up. She's been a leader. She's, you know, really taken her team to the next level and been an inspiration to her teammates, who someone like Suni Lee, Minnesota's own, told me yesterday she's proven that, you know, gymnasts can do anything. And, you know, Simone Biles is 27 years old. She's overcome a lot. And here she is still, you know, the GOAT.
Well, that is part of the debate, too. Yeah. Here she is, 27. Okay. She's accomplished so much.
Yes,
and some are wondering if she's going to go to L.A. Do you have to go?
I'm not asking that question. And I have to go.
Okay.
We'll talk later.
Okay. See ya. Yeah.
Bye.
I mean, Simone. I mean, I don't think Simone is giving proper respect to our conversation.
I think it's very clear she's not. They're just not getting any respect to it.
Yeah. I mean, you think maybe she'd have to come on the show now.
Be nice.
As a person. As a payback.
She could do a little demonstration, you know, a little floor routine in here. She could find the space.
So what was your first question? I assume because you were ripping her on the balance beam yesterday, that would be your first question.
That's my first question. What happened?
Yeah.
We call you the GOAT.
Wow. I mean, we almost lost Major Garrett, and we talked to Jamie for 18 seconds.
Roughly.
There was a lot. People don't realize all the behind-the-scenes juggling that took place in trying to get Major and Jamie. And in the end, I basically had to beg Major to do 12:35 because really his only window was 1:05. And then we chatted with Jamie for 47 seconds. And by the way, I don't blame Jamie at all. She can't really say to CBS, hey, I had Simone Biles, but I had to do this silly midday show where they pay me nothing and ask me these inane questions. And also they call me like 7 minutes late.
I think the pay me nothing thing, that would have... It would have worked on her behalf.
Yeah.
She would have said, look, I understand what you sent me here for, but this is so important.
That's my commitment.
I do this show for free once in a while.
Yeah. I mean, she's kind of bored with us now, too. I mean, we're sensing it.
I think you can take kind of right out of that sentence. Well, I have a feeling Simone was still like 8 people away.
What if it turns out that Gail is actually interviewing Simone Biles? And then when we see it and we text Jamie, she's like, oh, I was the conduit. You know, I just couldn't tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't think we should feel bad. I mean, she's the queen of the Olympics right now, Simone Biles. Jamie should have dumped us.
I thought you were saying Jamie was the queen of the Olympics.
No, I'm not.
Who's been to more Olympics, Jamie or Simone?
It's a fair question. Was this Jamie's fourth? So then it'd be Jamie, right? Biles, 31 in L.A. What's your guess?
Yes.
I think your comment the other day about her opponent and how great she is and get me away from her. Now, maybe it's just the moment, right? But that was a bit telling. I say no. Now, unless she just literally steps away for 3 years and does whatever she needs to do to qualify and feels like she can just turn it on like that. But maybe because of the twisties with the last Olympics, she doesn't feel like she can do that, that she has to be right in the whole meat grinder the entire time.
Yeah, you don't need four years of meat grinder, though. You could take a year or two off, stay in shape, but then get it back. I saw Katie Ledecky. She's 30, I think. And Tirico asked her about L.A., and her first response was, it would be a dream. Now I have to go through it and see that I want to keep swimming, that I still love the sport. But to, you know, participate in your home country for your country.
Okay, so not the literal age is olding, because I get that. I get math a little bit. What's older, a 34-year-old swimmer or a 31-year-old gymnast? They're both incredibly atypical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't remember watching a 34-year-old swimmer or a 31-year-old gymnast who were at the peak of their game. Now, maybe neither one would be at the peak, but they're both so bleeping good that they still could win. I mean, Ledecky in her events, maybe not quite as dominant, but still eviscerating a lot of folks, right?
Yes. I mean, in the 1500, she, you know, won by at least half a pool length. How old was... Now, Phelps is 39. I'm trying to remember. Was he at Tokyo or not?
No, it's been 8 years for him, right? So he was 31.
31?
Yeah. Yeah. I think with Major, I mentioned Spitz, too, and I meant Phelps.
Spitz works, though.
Spitz works.
That's very convenient.
Probably more for Major it works. I mean, he's, what, 30, 40 years older than me? Or maybe three?
One or two?
I think he's three. Is he going to dump us to, when he goes to the middle of nowhere in California, and I saw where he's going, it's the middle of nowhere. Is he going to, from his Ted Kaczynski-like compound, is he still going to join us in Fridays? And should we be worried what happens? Like, he's going to go from this really plugged-in guy to now he's just doing the copy machine all the time.
He's just going to play the hits. That's right.
He's just going to play the hits. Well, I think now, I mean, Walls is the story. Next hour, we have two more guests. We have Kurt Dowd, who, as we pointed out at the start of the show, has battled Tim Walls about as much as any public official in the state, right? And then we have Jacob Fry, who's inextricably linked with Tim Walls. Is Jacob Fry ready to be back in the news as much as he's about to be in the news? Right? Because the George Floyd riots are about to come up over and over and over again.
He's going to get a couple calls.
And he's going to be asked to participate in interviews. This is his first interview today, talking with us about this. I genuinely believe he's pleased for Tim Walls. I believe their relationship is much, much better than it was during everything that was going on, because, again, Jacob Fry reached out to Tim Walls days ahead of when Tim Walls responded. And it was, you know, wait, you didn't fill out the proper paperwork. Seemed a bit bizarre. It still seems a bit bizarre to me, too. But I doubt he wants to be brought back into this national conversation, but it's about to happen. So I think we should jump back into the Walls conversation. I think I should also tell you about Twins tickets.
Great plan.
Our ball club is rolling. I listened a little bit last night to Atterbury, and Gladden's on the road.
Mm-hmm. He likes Chicago.
Yeah, I heard it at the end of the Sunday game. This is the family trip. So he brought his 7-year-old grandson.
On the charter, right?
And Gladden was saying that he was confident. He was walking on the plane. He was talking with the guys.
How cool would that be?
That's
7 years old.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. How about the game? Don't call in now. But there's sometimes we're giving out dog tickets. Let's just be honest. Not this situation.
Mm-mm-mm. Schedule looks favorable.
This Sunday, a four-pack of tickets for the Cleveland Guardians. The team our club is chasing. And to quote a friend of mine who's talking right now, objects in your mirror are closer than they appear. 3.5 back now, right?
I think that's it. We picked up one last night, right?
The Guardians at 110. We've got a doubleheader on Friday, and I'm in a golf thing. Can I call in from the golf thing just on my phone and do 12 to 12:30, and that counts as a work day?
No, we actually prefer you don't.
Yeah. Well, maybe Adam and Jordan are back on the road. I have to do the golf show. I mean, I totally get what they were doing. There's like a somber moment going on for a great cause, and then you're trying to do wacky hijinks.
You can't yuck it up on the morning show, as Adam calls it.
You can't yuck it up when they're honoring deceased police officers. Hi, everybody! Pretty tough to do that in the background. So, Twin Ticket Tuesday, by the way, presented by Miller Marine and Power Lodge St. Cloud, Bennington Pontoon's largest dealer. So before this show is done, a chance to see your Guardians, the club the Twins are trying to chase down.
Just be the third caller when you hear that sounder, but we're not playing it right now.
Not now. More Tim Walz talk when we come back. Okay, we're talking about this today. Number one, Minnesota, 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 okay? Number two, this is a show where we like to talk politics. So would I be talking about this nearly as much if it was Shapiro? No. And this isn't to separate my shoulder, pat myself on the back. God knows I'll do that enough. But I think Josh Shapiro's a star. I really do. And I wish I could vote. I mean, I can. I guess I can write him in. My policy is I need the individual to actually run for the office for me to write them in. But if you told me right now my options are Donald Trump, Kamala Harris, or Josh Shapiro, I would vote for Josh Shapiro 1,000 out of 1,000 times. Because he gets things done. He works with the other side. He has an excellent relationship with law enforcement. And Donald Trump's a star, okay? Barack Obama is a star. Bill Clinton, star. Josh Shapiro is a star. Now, maybe it's just in Pennsylvania and for the rest of the politicos. But the more visible he is, the more people are going to realize that. But let's get to this question. Does any of this matter? It's the vice presidential pick. What percentage of people who are trying to decide between Donald Trump and his politics and the person he is and the person that Kamala Harris is and her politics are going to say, man, I'm a little torn right now with that Tim Walz pick over J.D. Vance, or that J.D. Vance pick over Tim Walz is going to be the tipping point. So if we say, of all the folks who are going to vote, 0%, 100%, the Tim Walz selection today influenced what percentage? Dave Harrigan.
One point eight percent.
Who are these folks? Who are the 1.8%? Are they folks who are Trump Vance supporters? Or let's put it this way. Excuse me. Are they folks? Major's right. We've had these folks, these boomerang folks, who are Obama, Trump. Maybe Trump again. Maybe Obama. Maybe Obama, Romney. Trump, whatever, where they actually do bounce back and forth. And they looked at the Tim Walz selection and said, nope, just two left for me. And even though I'm not crazy about Donald Trump, the human, because he's lacking in decency and character. He just is. I'm gonna go with Trump and Vance because of the selection. Are they also individuals within the Democrats Party who love how left this is? Where you're just appealing to the hardcore. You are appealing to the base. And let me also get back to the conversation I had with Major Garrett about Josh Shapiro and his religion. You are fully allowed to disagree with Josh Shapiro on policy after policy. I told you, we got a text recently from a longtime school teacher who doesn't agree at all with the voucher approach which Shapiro took. And I should have clarified this a little bit more. You should take a look at that. It's different than your typical voucher approach. It really is. So you're allowed to disagree with Shapiro. Can we also acknowledge that there is a troubling percentage of the far left where they're just anti-Semitic? They just are. Just like there is a troubling percentage on the right that is Islamophobic. And we see it too much through our texts. But the rise of anti-Semitism, Dave Harrigan, since October 7th, has been staggering. And if you're holding Josh Shapiro accountable for what he wrote, college paper, 28 years ago, get out of here. Josh Shapiro has called Benjamin Netanyahu one of the worst leaders of all time. He has called for a two-state solution, and there has been a staggering amount of generalizing, Dave, about him compared to Walls, Kelly, and others, because he's a Jew. So your 1.8% might be right in with a bunch of different categories. Is that fair, that it's not just all one?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's not a huge percent, obviously. People are going to care about the top of the ticket. It's Harris versus Trump.
Yep.
It's not Harris Walls versus Trump Vance in almost everybody's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, yeah. I mean, whether it's Minnesotans, whether it's, you know, Majors mentioned Wisconsin, Michigan.
Yep.
That Walls may gravitate towards them, may actually impact some voters, but it's not going to be a high percentage.
No. It's at the margins. At best. I listen, with Trump, when Trump says VP selections don't matter, could some of that been related to how awful Vance has been perceived so far? A little, but more of it's two things, the truth and his ego.
Yeah, I think, personally, I think VP selections will never win you an election. They can't help you lose an election.
That's probably.
See Sarah Palin.
Yeah, right. With Harris, because she's such an unknown so far, could it have a little more of an effect? Maybe. But let's see when she's out there more, when she participates in some interviews, and then there's just going to be little talk about Tim Walz. Aaron David Miller on this show, I don't know, 50 times, a lot, as a great Middle East guest. Are we about to face a horrifying situation in the Middle East? Aaron is moments away on CCO. We are fortunate to say that Aaron David Miller has joined us a number of times over the last couple decades. Presently, Aaron is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was a member of the Secretary of State's office for 24 years. He served six different secretaries of state, and he's always a great guest. And like all of our guests, he's on the John Schuster Caldwell Banker hotline. This tweet, though, from Aaron a couple days ago certainly drew my attention and caused this phone call. This is from Aaron just a couple days ago. Nobody wants it and not predicting it, but we're closer than ever to something the Middle East has never seen before, a genuine regional war encompassing fronts in Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and even the Gulf. So, Aaron, it's always a pleasure to have you on. That is obviously a troubling, concerning, and informed tweet. How close are we?
Impossible to say, Chad. First of all, thanks for having me. As I mentioned, I'm not predicting it. Nobody wants it. Closer than ever means that there are two uncertain events yet to occur, which are impossible to predict, which could take us to the scenario that I identified. Number one, the nature of Iran and Hezbollah, as well as the other members of the so-called resistance axis against Israel, in retaliation for two strikes, two assassinations, one of the Israelis claimed, a strike against a very senior Hezbollah commander, very close to the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, and the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas's external leadership, its political bureau, which the Israelis presumably were responsible for but are not admitting. This has left Iran in a perilous position of having to try to respond to something that goes well beyond what they did April 13, 2014, in which, again, in response to an Israeli strike on the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps commander in Damascus, they responded with over 300 mm-hmm. high-trajectory weapons, cruise missiles, short-range ballistic missiles, attack drones, causing no damage. 99% of them never even made it into Israeli airspace. But this time, I suspect, having been humiliated and having their security system revealed to be essentially bankrupt, the Israelis apparently planted a remotely detonated explosives in an IRGC compound where Ismail Haniyeh was staying in the actual room in which he was staying.
And they planted it months and months before, right?
Exactly, remotely yeah. detonated, although the Iranians claim this was done by a standoff missile. So that leads to the first shoe, basically, and that is, what is the nature? What will be the nature of the Iranian response? Hezbollah's response, and remember, Hezbollah is in a position to do far more damage to the Israelis than Iran. It takes roughly, 12 minutes for a cruise missile to travel from Iran to Israel. It takes a matter of seconds for any of Hezbollah's high-trajectory weapons, and they have roughly 150,000 of them of varying ranges, lethalities, and precision, to strike Israel. So it's the Hezbollah response. It's the response from Iran. When it will come, what it will be is unclear. So that's the first issue. The second, of course, will be the Israeli response. And that's going to depend in large part, obviously, on the nature and the character and the comprehensiveness of Iran and its proxies' actions against Israel. So, again, not predicting it. Nobody wants it. Closer than surely we've ever been.
So let me get to the first shoe, the response from either Iran, Hezbollah, or the coordination between the two. Are you surprised it has not happened yet, or is it possible that one attempt was made and the Israelis already stopped it?
No, I think, remember in April when we saw an Iranian response, responding to an Israeli strike in Damascus, which occurred on April 1st, the Iranians waited 2 weeks before they launched these high-trajectory weapons at Israel. Haniyeh, the Hamas leader, was killed July 31. We're about 8 days in. The uncertainty, the sense of where and when we don't know, I suppose, is part of the Iranian playbook here. They also are facing a critically important decision. And I think the delay reflects their own uncertainty about how to respond. They need to demonstrate mm-hmm. both competency, effectiveness, and they need to do serious damage. But they need to achieve all those objectives without tripping into a major confrontation, because the asymmetry of power between Israel and Iran favoring Israel is in terms of unmanned area vehicles, cruise missiles, drones, is asymmetrical in favor of Israel. And add to that the defensive capacities of two carrier strike groups, U.S. carrier strike groups, a number of warships with very sophisticated and aircraft fighters with very sophisticated anti-ballistic defensive capabilities, and the Iranians would be overmatched, to say the least. They do not want a regional war. But again, can they navigate the fine line between doing damage, but not too much damage, that would prompt an Israeli response? And again, the real problem, I suspect, is not Iran. It's the geography is destiny, Chad. And Hezbollah is much closer. They also, of course, have to worry about it because they're vulnerable to what would almost certainly be a massive Israeli strike should they do damage to infrastructure, civilian casualties, military bases. So that prompts a kind of escalatory cycle, which is why we can't rule it out. We can't rule a regional war out, even though I still believe it's not inevitable, and I think it can be avoided, but we'll see.
Aaron David Miller is with us right now, senior fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a phenomenal experience in this man's life, part of the Secretary of State's office, almost 25 years served, six different secretaries of state. You have been a part of negotiations where Netanyahu, he's right in the middle of it. You've observed him for decade after decade after decade. You've watched how he has reacted since October 7th. So if we get this, or it's probably when we get this Hezbollah attack, and when now he has to walk this line, and this line is also showing Israeli citizens that I'm going to respond with force like I have since October 7th, for the folks who want that, and also paying attention to a lot of the world who feel like he has went too far and that too many innocent civilians have died. How much trust do you have, if the attack takes place, that Netanyahu will respond with a global thought versus this is vengeance, I'm the leader of Israel, and I'm responding specifically in that manner?
You know, it's a very good question, and I guess I would start by answering it, saying this, that the organizing principle of Benjamin Netanyahu's life of late, certainly since October 7, and even before, is to maintain himself in power. He's on trial in a Jerusalem district court before three judges for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. If he loses power, that is to say, he ceases to become prime minister, he faces two possibilities. One, a conviction, and there's precedent there. Ehud Olmert, a former Israeli prime minister, served 16 months, I believe, in prison for just one of the charges that Netanyahu faces. Or alternatively, to negotiate for a plea bargain that would drive him out of power. So that means maintaining power. That means presiding over the most extreme right-wing government in Israel's history, with two ministers, Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, who are committed to annexing the West Bank in everything but name. And I suspect it's this devil's bargain that creates the most important constituency for Mr. Netanyahu. 64 seats. You need 60 plus one to govern. He's got 64. That coalition is very cohesive. And to quote one of our founding fathers, Sam Adams, we're either going to hang together or we're going to hang separately. There's no challenge right now. There are no effective opposition, despite massive public protests.
That's stunning.
Despite the efforts of the Netanyahu government before October 7th to rearrange the political furniture in Israel and emasculate the Supreme Court. And the fact is, Benjamin Netanyahu, since October 7th, has presided over the bloodiest single day for Jews since the end of the Nazi Holocaust. and the greatest intelligence failure in Israel's history. And yet, Israel at war and a public exhausted but determined, I think, to support, to continue the prosecution of the war in Gaza against Hamas and to kill its senior leaders, has essentially acquiesced in his leadership. That said, like Iran and Hezbollah, and certainly let's include the Biden administration, Mr. Netanyahu does not want a major regional war. Continuation of the current war and the war of attrition against Hamas and Gaza.
We are fortunate to say that Aaron David Miller has joined us a number of times over the last couple decades. Presently, Aaron is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was a member of the Secretary of State's office for 24 years. He served six different secretaries of state, and he's always a great guest. And like all of our guests, he's on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker hotline. This tweet, though, from Aaron a couple days ago certainly drew my attention and caused this phone call. This is from Aaron just a couple days ago. Nobody wants it and not predicting it, but we're closer than ever to something the Middle East has never seen before, a genuine regional war encompassing fronts in Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and even the Gulf. So, Aaron, it's always a pleasure to have you on. That is obviously a troubling, concerning, and informed tweet. How close are we?
Impossible to say, Chad. First of all, thanks for having me. As I mentioned, I'm not predicting it. Nobody wants it. Closer than ever means that there are two uncertain events yet to occur, which are impossible to predict, which could take us to the scenario that I identified. Number one, the nature of Iran and Hezbollah, as well as the other members of the so-called resistance against Israel, in retaliation for two strikes, two assassinations, one the Israelis claimed, a strike against a very senior Hezbollah commander, very close to the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, and the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas's external leadership, its political bureau, which the Israelis presumably were responsible for but are not admitting. This has left Iran in a perilous position of having to try to respond to something that goes well beyond what they did April 13, 14, in which, again, in response to an Israeli strike on the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps commander in Damascus, they responded with over 300 mm-hmm. high-trajectory weapons, cruise missiles, short-range ballistic missiles, attack drones, causing no damage. 99% of them never even made it into Israeli airspace. But this time, I suspect, having been humiliated and having their security system revealed to be essentially bankrupt, the Israelis apparently planted a remotely detonated explosives in an IRGC compound where Ismail Haniyeh was staying in the actual room in which he was staying.
And they planted it months and months before, right?
Exactly, remotely detonated, although the Iranians claim this was done by a standoff missile. So that leads to the first shoe, basically, and that is, what is the nature? What will be the nature of the Iranian response? Hezbollah's response, and remember, Hezbollah is in a position to do far more damage to the Israelis than Iran. It takes roughly, 12 minutes for a cruise missile to travel from Iran to Israel. It takes a matter of seconds for any of Hezbollah's high-trajectory weapons, and they have roughly 150,000 of them of varying ranges, lethalities, and precision, to strike Israel. So it's the Hezbollah response. It's the response from Iran. When it will come, what it will be is unclear. So that's the first issue. The second, of course, will be the Israeli response. And that's going to depend in large part, obviously, on the nature and the character and the comprehensiveness of Iran and its proxies' actions against Israel. So, again, not predicting it. Nobody wants it. But again, closer than surely we've ever been.
So let me get to the first shoe, the response from either Iran, Hezbollah, or the coordination between the two. Are you surprised it has not happened yet? Or is it possible that one attempt was made and the Israelis already stopped it?
No, I think, remember in April when the, when we saw an Iranian response, again, responding to an Israeli strike in Damascus, which occurred on April 1st. The Iranians waited 2 weeks before they launched these high-trajectory weapons at Israel. Haniya, the Hamas leader, was killed July 31. We're about 8 days in. The uncertainty, the sense of where and when, we don't know, I suppose, is part of the Iranian playbook here. They also are facing a critically important decision. And I think the delay reflects their own uncertainty about how to respond. They need to demonstrate both competency, effectiveness, and they need to do serious damage. But they need to achieve all those objectives without tripping into a major confrontation, because the asymmetry of power between Israel and Iran favoring Israel is in terms of unmanned aerial vehicles, cruise missiles, drones, is asymmetrical in favor of Israel. And add to that the defensive capacities of two carrier strike groups, U.S. carrier strike groups, a number of warships with very sophisticated and aircraft fighters with very sophisticated anti-ballistic defensive capabilities, and the Iranians would be overmatched, to say the least. They do not want a regional war. But again, can they navigate the fine line between doing damage, but not too much damage, that would prompt an Israeli response? And again, the real problem, I suspect, is not Iran. It's the geography is destiny, Chad. And Hezbollah is much closer. They also, of course, have to worry about it because they're vulnerable to what would almost certainly be a massive Israeli strike should they do damage to infrastructure, civilian casualties, military bases. So that prompts a kind of escalatory cycle, which is why we can't rule it out. We can't rule a regional war out, even though I still believe it's not inevitable, and I think it can be avoided, but we'll see.
Aaron David Miller is with us right now, senior fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a phenomenal experience in this man's life, part of the Secretary of State's office, almost 25 years, served six different secretaries of state. You have been a part of negotiations where Netanyahu, he's right in the middle of it. You've observed him for decade after decade after decade. You've watched how he has reacted since October 7th. So if we get this, or it's probably when we get this Hezbollah attack, and when now he has to walk this line, and this line is also showing Israeli citizens that I'm going to respond with force like I have since October 7th. For the folks who want that, and also paying attention to a lot of the world who feel like he has went too far and that too many innocent civilians have died. How much trust do you have, if the attack takes place, that Netanyahu will respond with a global thought versus this is vengeance, I'm the leader of Israel, and I'm responding specifically in that manner?
You know, it's a very good question, and I guess I would start by answering it, saying this, that the organizing principle of Benjamin Netanyahu's life of late, certainly since October 7, and even before, is to maintain himself in power. He's on trial in a Jerusalem district court before three judges for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. If he loses power, that is to say, he ceases to become prime minister, he faces two possibilities. One, a conviction. And there's precedent there. Ehud Olmert, a former Israeli prime minister, served 16 months, I believe, in prison for just one of the charges that Netanyahu faces. Or alternatively, to negotiate for a plea bargain that would drive him out of power. So that means maintaining power. That means presiding over the most extreme right-wing government in Israel's history, with two ministers, Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, who are committed to annexing the West Bank in everything but name. And I suspect it's this devil's bargain that creates the most important constituency for Mr. Netanyahu. 64 seats. You need 60 plus one to govern. He's got 64. That coalition is very cohesive. And to quote one of our founding fathers, Sam Adams, we're either going to hang together or we're going to hang separately. There's no challenge right now. There are no effective opposition, despite massive public protests.
That's stunning.
Despite the efforts of the Netanyahu government before October 7th to rearrange the political furniture in Israel and emasculate the Supreme Court. And the fact is, Benjamin Netanyahu, since October 7th, has presided over the bloodiest single day for Jews since the end of the Nazi Holocaust and the greatest intelligence failure in Israel's history. And yet, Israel at war and a public exhausted but determined, I think, to support, to continue the prosecution of the war in Gaza against Hamas and to kill its senior leaders, has essentially acquiesced in his leadership. That said, like Iran and Hezbollah, and certainly let's include the Biden administration, Mr. Netanyahu does not want a major regional war. Continuation of the current war and the war of attrition against Hamas in Gaza, against Hezbollah, that serves his purpose. Because the minute these wars come to an end, the question of accountability is going to be raised within Israel. And that accountability, if you believe the polls, would result in his inability to form a new government. So I think he and the Knesset is now in recess, which means won't come back until the end of October. It means that Benjamin Netanyahu will be able to assess who the next president of the United States is. And he'll adjust his tactics and strategy accordingly. Elections in Israel, I would say, barring something that neither you nor I can divine, won't occur until probably the spring of 2025.
Aaron, you're great. Thank you so much. I know you're in heavy demand. We always appreciate the time. And be assured we'll reach out again.
Thanks, Chad. Thanks for having me.
Aaron David Miller. Just outstanding informed information. When you're part of the Secretary of State's office for 24 years, when you've worked with six different secretaries of state, both parties, you get great information. Speaking of Iran, speaking of Donald Trump, there is news regarding Donald Trump, Iran, and a Pakistani man and an assassination plot. Let's give you that information on the international news continuing when we come back and remind you next hour, two excellent guests tied to Tim Walz's selection today. Kurt Dowd, the former Speaker of the House. They worked together. They jousted. At times on this show, Kurt Dowd has been kind to Tim Walz. At other times, he has absolutely crushed Tim Walz. What will Kurt Dowd say today? And Jacob Frey, the mayor of Minneapolis, who is going to be back in the news because of this Tim Walz selection and a lot of talk about the George Floyd riots. Jacob Frey talks to the media first with us at 2:35. So this is rather frightening news, to say the least. Justice Department is breaking the last half hour or so. Charge a Pakistani man who has alleged ties to the Iranian government with seeking to carry out political assassinations that prompted the U.S. government to increase security for Donald Trump and other officials. FBI investigators believe Trump and other current U.S. Government officials were the intended targets Asif Merchant is 46, accused of traveling to New York City, working with a hitman to carry out the assassinations in late August of this month, obviously, and early September. He was arrested July 12th while preparing to leave the U.S., prosecutor said, shortly after he met with the purported hitman who we believe would carry out the murders, but were actually undercover law enforcement agents. The FBI believes it foiled Merchant's plot before any attack, and the week since his arrest, he has cooperated with investigators. But the Iranian government's known threats against Trump prompted the FBI to pass on the intelligence to the Secret Service, which increased security protection for the former president. Okay, that's scary. That's frightening. I guess we don't know all the different attempts which are made against a current president or a former president. It seems so far from the reporting that this is not tied to the other assassination attempt, but I don't fault the soul for saying, are we sure?
How is that not the first thing you think?
Do we have all the information yet? And was this guy the only guy? So more on this from CBS, and also we'll pay close attention, and so will all the other outlets. So this is rather frightening news, to say the least. Justice Department is breaking the last half hour or so. Charge a Pakistani man who has alleged ties to the Iranian government was seeking to carry out political assassinations that prompted the U.S. government to increase security for Donald Trump and other officials. FBI investigators believe Trump and other current U.S. Government officials were the intended targets. Asif Merchant is 46, accused of traveling to New York City, working with a hitman to carry out the assassinations in late August of this month, obviously, and early September. He was arrested July 12th while preparing to leave the U.S., prosecutor said, shortly after he met with the purported hitman who we believe would carry out the murders, but were actually undercover law enforcement agents. The FBI believes it foiled Merchant's plot before any attack, and the week since his arrest, he has cooperated with investigators. But the Iranian government's known threats against Trump prompted the FBI to pass on the intelligence to the Secret Service, which increased security protection for the former president. Okay, that's scary. That's frightening. I guess we don't know all the different attempts which are made against a current president or a former president. It seems so far from the reporting that this is not tied to the other assassination attempt. But I don't fault the soul for saying, are we sure?
How is that not the first thing you think?
Do we have all the information yet? And was this guy the only guy? So more on this from CBS, and also we'll pay close attention, and so will all the other outlets.